ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
The latest racing news. It's At The Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Well, that's a quick return, and that, well, maybe it's not a quick return. Jay, I mean Jay, Kay, right? That we're back, aren't we? Yeah. It seems like you restarted the. Did you restart the ads? That was funny. Happy to have Alan Foreman join us on the heels of the visit with Jay Privman and Alan. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and let me add my congratulations to Jay. I've had the privilege of being interviewed by him, of having spent time with him. He's an industry treasure. He's been one of the great journalists in our history, and just absolute congratulations on his great career. And he really has been such a credit to the sport.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And looking now looking for, I wasn't necessarily going to go to the Eclipse Awards, but I'm going to be down in Florida. So will you be in attendance?
I will. I'm in Florida now, and I'm looking forward to it. I understand it's sold out, and I'm happy to see that. And it's a credit to Tom Rooney and Keith Chamblin and Breeders' Cup and Jockey Club and all those who are putting a terrific event together this year.
Well, we're looking forward then. All right. Let me bring up the topic at large, and Alan, I reached for you because of the volleys exchanged over the last week, give or take. Natalie Voss wrote a very interesting piece that called into question Ramon Preciado, who is pretty much ruled off and who's seemingly showing up at Fair Hill as an assistant, essentially. And then the follow-up to that piece, this appeared, of course, at Pollock Report, where Natalie does her writing, and the response by Alan Pincus, who, of course, you've known your whole career.
Sure.
More or less excoriating the source material and challenging any question of Michael Jones as a paper trainer, and I'm not interested in debating those particular specifics. What I would love you to discuss is this concept in general, the paper trainer challenge, and who's responsible for tracking this kind of circumstance, and you know where the regulators start and finish, where the racetrack starts and finishes, because I don't recall, Alan, us ever having this discussion.
Well, I don't recall if we had the discussion in the most recent instance prior to this one of a paper trainer when Wayne Potts was asked to vacate stalls at Laurel and ended up at the Naira tracks, and he was excluded from Maryland because he was accused of being a paper trainer for Marcus Vitale, who was a bar trainer. So this was in the press several years ago. I look back, the only previous instance I could see of regulatory action or questions of paper training was, I think, back in 2012 at Keeneland, involving some individuals, and what turned out to be a relatively innocent situation and not where there was an attempt to evade regulatory authorities to the extent that the suggestion is being made here. I have seen it quite a bit in harness racing, and when I was counsel to the Maryland Racing Commission, we saw it, and over the years as I was doing private work, occasionally there would be accusations in the standardbred industry of someone paper training for another individual who had a sordid history or a questionable background. And the interesting thing about paper training is that when a person puts his name down as the or her name down as the trainer, and that is listed on the program, that person is deemed to be the responsible person for whatever happens, whether it's a medication violation or some other regulatory violation. Historically, regulators didn't look beyond who was listed on the program as the trainer, and that's who they would prosecute. So if you had an individual, even if licensed, who had some kind of a sordid history and couldn't afford more violations on their record, or somehow they were trying to obscure the fact that they were the trainer, they would get someone else who wasn't actually the trainer to go down as the paper trainer. A little bit different than if you've got, you know, someone who is training horses at Oaklawn and wants to train in Maryland and get somebody locally in Maryland to go down as the trainer on the horses. They get shipped up. The risk for it, the trainer who receives the horses always was, well, you know, you're notwithstanding you haven't trained the horses, you're running the risk that if there is, for example, a medication violation, you're going to take the penalty because your name is on the program. That's why they call it a paper or program trainer. It's the person whose name is listed on the program, but may, for all intents and purposes, not be the trainer. And it usually involves someone with a questionable background.
How exactly is this policed, and what are the legalities exactly, Alan? I mean, if there's somebody that they may not be eligible to be licensed again as a trainer, quote unquote, but are they licensable as a groom, as a shed captain, as a foreman, or whatever? Or does the racetrack rule them off completely? I mean, explain the balance between racetrack limitations and authority versus the regulators' limitations and authority.
Yeah, and let me add a third layer to that, because the case that we're talking about now involving Preciado, where the activity was taking place at Fair Hill, which, at least prior to Heisa, was not under the jurisdiction of any of the Maryland Racing Commission, okay? And that has always been somewhat of a bugaboo in Maryland, that you've got trainers and you've got a regular training activity and published works being done at Fair Hill, but Maryland's Racing Commission's jurisdiction only extends to the grounds of the racetrack. So they technically cannot regulate conduct at Fair Hill. And I think Mike Hopkins, who's executive director of the commission, said that when he was interviewed by the Pollock Report. When you're dealing with activity on the racetrack, the only personnel that are allowed on the racetrack are licensed personnel. Now, in this case, Preciado was able to get restored in Pennsylvania with, I guess, was it a groom's license or an assistant license?
Yeah.
Some kind of license that was not a trainer's license. And, you know, I guess people would argue, well, that's really a subterfuge. He's on the backstretch. He's in the barn. He's working with the horses. What really prevents him from actually being the trainer of the horses, notwithstanding he's not licensed as a trainer? So, you know, there's somewhat of a suspicion that there's a ruse there. And then you have horses that are training at sites all around a state or a jurisdiction that are not under the jurisdiction of a racing commission. And there's nothing to prevent those individuals to, quote unquote, go to the farm and train horses at the farm and then have them ship into the racetrack. So it's a sticky wicket, to say the least. And how do you police it? Well, it's word of mouth, it's complaints, it's calls like were made here, calls to the Racing Commission, calls to Pollock, and those who want to investigate will, you know, look to see, you know, who is actually training the horses. Who is the owner paying? Who are the employees? How is the activity being conducted? Who is arranging the daily sets? Who's supervising the horses on the course? Because typically that was the trainer or the assistant trainer. In this case, the allegation is that Michael Jones, who is the actual trainer, is at Charlestown, and he comes in occasionally to see what's going on with his operation at Fair Hill. And then it's really Preciado who's doing the training. And when these horses go to the track, they have been trained by Preciado. And then Jones just goes down as the paper trainer for the race itself, because clearly Preciado is not licensed to do so. The key has always been, who's the responsible person? Who's going to take the fall if there is a violation? And, you know, that's the only reason why typically you would have a paper trainer or someone willing to do it for someone else, someone willing to take the fall or willing to get into an arrangement that may financially benefit that person based on whatever activity they're performing for the trainer. And then the question is, what does the owner know and what is the owner permitting? And that's part of the investigation that I think is still ongoing here.
Is there, Alan, that we should know of or do know of, is there specific rules that apply to the exclusion of an individual under the circumstance?
I assume if a regulatory body wanted to pursue a violation, they could under the general corrupt practices rule that prohibits fraud or some conduct that's not in the best interest of racing. And so the argument probably would be here that this is just a fraud or it's a, you know, it's conduct that's detrimental to the sport. What Alan Pincus is arguing is, you know, that these are just allegations. There's action being taken, and reputations are being harmed without any kind of due process whatsoever. That gets back to the issue we've been dealing with now for 2 years, and that is exclusion of individuals and licensees by racetracks, based on some information that they possess that they are not, you know, bound by the rules of regulatory bodies. New York now, in a situation like this, if they were to take action, would have to give a hearing to the individuals before they take action. There are other tracks where a hearing is not required. Interestingly, and I know nothing about this case independently of what I've read, but First Racing has indicated they're not going to accept entries from this ownership and this trainer, unless they're horses that are coming down from Charlestown, where they believe Michael Jones is actually training. And Maryland Jockey Club was the first to move against Wayne Potts when it was alleged that he was the paper trainer for Marcus Vitale. And then, of course, Potts ends up in New York, and there's further proceedings in New York. But so the Strada Group, First Racing, has a history of dealing with these kinds of situations where they're not going to permit fraudulent conduct to take place or allege fraudulent conduct. I'm not suggesting there's merit or not merit to this situation. I don't know. But I think they're taking the position that it's conduct that's not in their best interest, and therefore they're not going to take entries for horses that are coming from this operation from Fair Hill.
Graham Motion is quoted regarding Fair Hill that, you know, that the, I guess the condo association, condo association rules govern Fair Hill, which is interesting, basically being operated as a collective.
Well, I would throw one change that it was not focused on in this article, and that is that Heiser now has jurisdiction to some extent in this situation. And I would ask the question, is Preciado registered with HISA? I don't know that for a fact, but under HISA, and the safety program is in effect, the constitutionality of HISA, at least the safety program, according to the FTC, is that it's been upheld, and therefore they're going to continue with the safety program. Under the safety program, all covered persons, covered person is the trainer, the owner, the trainer's employees, and anyone who has any contact with the horses. Okay, so arguably Preciado has to be registered with HISA. Therefore, HISA has jurisdiction, and under HISA, whatever the operation is, the entity that is managing a horse has to designate the so-called responsible person. And that person is going to be held responsible for all violations under HISA. It doesn't limit HISA from going after other individuals. But clearly under HISA, if, for example, Michael Jones is the responsible person for all of these horses, regardless of their location, for HISA's purposes, he is deemed to be the responsible person. Doesn't bar HISA if in an enforcement action from going against others, but the responsible person is the one that who's going to suffer the major consequences. And HISA has the ability, and HISA might be more willing. I don't know, since this is somewhat of a new, unique situation, but HISA clearly has the authority to investigate these circumstances and take regulatory action where racing commissions might not be so quick and willing to do so. And by the way, Fair Hill training centers where published works are conducted are now under the jurisdiction of HISA.
Right.
So
right.
Fair Hill now is fair game. And it doesn't really matter from the condo association's perspective. What they're saying is we can't deny someone the right to purchase or acquire a condo with stalls at Fair Hill based on their race, color, creed, or whatever. We're not getting into the regulatory aspects of it. There really is nothing that would prohibit. In this case, it's the owner who has purchased the condo and brought his employees in, and that's how Fair Hill works.
Well, and so that seems to be the unusual circumstance that is involved here.
Well, it was until now, with HISA in effect, to the extent that the Maryland Racing Commission didn't have jurisdiction. HISA does, and HISA can step in if it chooses to do so based on information it receives. And yeah. Really, isn't that part of HISA's mandate, is the integrity of the sport and the safety and welfare of the horses? I mean, that's right in their wheelhouse. So, and HISA's existence and whatever enforcement powers that HISA has does not affect the ability of racetracks to determine that they believe illicit conduct is going on and they're not going to permit certain individuals on their property. Their decisions have no reciprocity, whereas if a racing commission were to take an action, that would be reciprocal across all jurisdictions. And the same thing with HISA, but when the racetrack does it, it only relates to that specific racetrack.
Does this, in a general sense, Alan, does Alan Foreman with us discussing the paper trainer comes up, with semi-regularity. Kind of fit into the boots on the ground, the TRPB conversation that we've been having off and on?
Absolutely, no question about it. If there had been a vibrant Thoroughbred Racing Protective Bureau in existence, this information would have been exchanged very quickly. There would have been, I suspect, continuing intelligence, and there would be continuing intelligence against anyone whose background would suggest that person needs to be followed. I mean, when you see people who have had numerous violations who are back, trainers will say, well, how did this individual get back? Or did you know this individual was at so-and-so? I mean, that's how you investigate these things. A vibrant TRPD would have kept track of the individuals and would have had the authority to out this. With subpoena power now and the kinds of powers that HISA has been given by Congress, it's the kind of thing that, when horsemen start complaining and you start to see a pattern, that they can investigate and institute enforcement action. And that was one of the reasons why people like Graham Motion, I think, were happy about HISA, because, when you see somebody at your facility, and the people at Fair Hill really value integrity, these are high quality people at Fair Hill, when they see something that bothers them or doesn't seem right or just seems to be inimical to the best interest of the industry, they're going to weigh in.
Well, I suppose to some degree this also brings us, been a quiet opening almost fortnight now to the year. The day we went on vacation, Alan, the spending bill a comprehensive omnibus style piece of legislation was used as the carrier of a HISA related piece of legislation. Where do we stand from what you're monitoring here, 12 days into the year?
Right. I have no inside information, so I can only comment or predict based upon what I see. There was an announcement, I think, the day before yesterday by Ben Mosher, who's heading which will be the independent agency overseeing the anti-doping program, that their expectation is that they will be able to start the anti-doping program on March 15th. Perhaps they know something that I don't know, but today is tomorrow is March 13th. 60 days from now would be this is January 13th. 2 months from now would be March 13th. They're talking March 15th. The Federal Trade Commission has not announced that they are publishing the regulations, and there is a 60-day period between when those regulations are published and final action and implementation can take place. So there's going to have to be an announcement today or tomorrow or over the weekend that the FTC has published the regulations. And the FTC has to make a decision here, and perhaps that's what's under consideration, is are they comfortable enough with the legislative fix that was contained in the omnibus bill? Are they satisfied that now puts them on solid ground to move forward with the anti-doping program? Or are they going to wait to see what the Fifth Circuit does? You may recall that the Fifth Circuit indicated when it issued its ruling that its mandate would go into effect on January the 10th. And I have not seen, nor am I aware of, the issuance of that mandate. So their ruling has not taken effect yet. We do know, and not surprisingly, that HISA's attorneys filed an emergency petition with the Fifth Circuit asking them, based on the new language, to reconsider and vacate their ruling, meaning uphold the constitutionality of HISA based on the change in the language and the lower court decision. I suspect the Fifth Circuit is considering that petition, has asked for a response from the plaintiffs in the case, and are going to weigh the arguments, whether they will conduct any oral argument or just make a decision, we don't know. And, it's conceivable that FTC wants to wait to see what the Fifth Circuit does before they move. We know whatever happens, there's going to be more legal challenges. But I think that HISA is anxious to get the program started. And if the Fifth Circuit were to vacate its ruling, I think the FTC will move immediately. And what will happen is the FTC is going to publish, I believe, the exact same rules that we were waiting for them to take final action on when they reversed themselves and backed off without prejudice, if you recall. So some people have asked, well, isn't there going to be a 60-day comment period? And yeah, but there's been a pre-comment period already. There's been a formal comment period already. So it strikes me that if the FTC republishes unless they had some comments that we have not seen, it's going to be a pretty pro forma situation where they will wait the whatever time frame they specify, if they can do it expedited, whatever that means. But whatever that comment period, you can expect they'll publish, they'll wait until that expires, and then mandate that the program goes into effect. But it's a pretty tight timeline if March 15th is the date that HIWU expects the program to start. I think more realistically, even if that was the case, it would be more responsible to start on April 1. But hopefully there will be a sufficient lag time to make sure the industry is ready to comply with the new rules.
Well, we'll continue to watch and monitor and respond. I suppose, Alan, while I have you as well, let me fold in one other Alan Foreman related topic. Any development toward the situation in Maryland regarding the stipend that comes from the gaming?
Well, it's what's going on in Maryland is just a massive challenge. We are 3 years from when the concept plan was first introduced. That is, for those aren't familiar with it, the redevelopment of Pimlico Racecourse and consolidation of racing at Laurel and a redevelopment of Laurel Racecourse with a sale of bonds and a price tag that at the time was priced at $375 million to do both facilities. We got hit with COVID. We got hit with what was the inflationary increases in cost of materials and supplies. And then we just got whacked last year with the bond market changing. So we're in a different place today financially with this program than we were when we started. We do not have as much money to work with. And quite frankly, the cost of the project now substantially exceeds what we predicted, and there isn't sufficient or aren't sufficient funds to do it. Notwithstanding that, the Pimlico portion has been moving forward, although perhaps at a snail's pace. There is still tremendous design work and issues and considerations for the industry, both at Pimlico and apart from Pimlico, that we're working through. And there is a tax issue that vexes this entire project. And that is a tax, it's a provision of the Internal Revenue Code that is directed at wealthy owners of sports franchises and stadiums and arenas. And if there are improvements that are done to their facilities with public dollars, the value of those improvements are taxed to capital gains rates. And for Belinda Stronach at Laurel, because that property is not being donated, Pimlico is being donated, you're looking at a substantial five-figure a capital gains tax that clearly they're not willing to incur. And the only way you get around that tax problem is to convey the property to the state. And so that's going to require action by the Maryland General Assembly, a willingness to acquire the property, and what is an analysis that we're doing right now of the entire industry and how we can best position the industry with the redevelopment of Pimlico. So it's a lot of rhetoric, but boy, this is the most complicated thing I've ever worked on, Steve. I just have never encountered anything like this.
And how about the stipend portion of from Maryland Live and from the gaming that has
right.
been a vital really a lifeblood that really stabilized things the last it's 9 years, right? It's coming due.
Well, we have a which was called the 10-year agreement that really helped Maryland to stabilize itself. For the benefit of your viewers, we do not have gaming at our racetracks in Maryland. There was an opportunity for Frank Stronach to acquire a gaming license at Laurel. He, for any number of reasons, filed an application without paying the fee that was required. He was declared ineligible. That failure, and for the industry, became Maryland Live and one of the most successful casinos in the United States, built by a developer by the name of Dave Cordish. The industry, separate and apart from the racetrack, gets a portion of every slot dollar, not table game dollar, but slot dollar wagered at our casinos. And that goes into an account called the purse dedication account. And that's been growing each year as gaming has been growing. We also will get a piece of sports betting, although that's not anticipated to be a substantial amount of money. And we are dedicating $5 million a year from that fund into this redevelopment program. We're one of the chief financial supporters of paying for the cost of the bonds. The 10-year agreement has expired. We have agreed with First Racing to extend it for 6 months as we work through all these issues of the redevelopment plan. And when that when we get to June 30th, we may be having a different conversation with you. But that's where we stand right now.
All right. Well, I'm pleased that we could catch up on all of it. And Alan, as always, I appreciate the insight on a topic that is not widely discussed when it came to the paper trainer paper trail.
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and always look forward to it.
I will see you in Florida, I guess.
See you in 2 weeks.
Very good. Great. There it is, Alan Foreman.
Best to everybody. Thank you.
There he is. Can't beat it. We're going to round out with a visit by Rich Eng, and I'm reminded by Dave Hill that I'm going to have to shift Dave to tomorrow for the NFL conversation, which actually makes some sense because there's no Thursday game. So as long as Dave is okay for tomorrow, we'll do the NFL feature, and it's a quiet racing weekend, as it happens. So it's and Dave is responding. Okay, he's good for tomorrow. Perfect. All right, because I would not. There's a few things I want to celebrate. What a great job he did all through the regular season, and we want what is it? Six games, right? Two Saturday, three Sunday, and one Monday. Yeah, that right. That's I really looked at the schedule. I looked when I've got the lines here somewhere, but I haven't looked back at them. I know there's been there's been a bunch of movement because of quarterback issues. Right? Is Tua playing? I think the Dolphins the Dolphins situation is big and so forth. Rich Eng is standing by and. We welcome Rich. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Rich, I got any number of things to touch base with you, but first and foremost, happy, healthy. We didn't talk last week, so just getting going. First visit of the year.
Oh, yeah. We turned the page, the calendar page to 2023, and I hope everybody, if I haven't spoken to them in a while, had a nice Christmas, holidays, whatever celebration people enjoy this time of year, plus a happy new year.
Perfect, and nothing makes the new year happier than the arrival of Betting on Horse Racing for Dummies, Volume 2.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate that, and I've gotten really positive feedback from people who ordered the book on Amazon or picked it up at the bookstore, and that warms my heart because I worked all year, about 9 months on it, and the content I tried to update it from 2004 when I wrote the first edition, and there's a lot of changes. There's a lot of changes in our industry, and I just tried to keep track of a lot of things. I know a couple people said to me, why their product or service wasn't in the book. And quite frankly, there are dozens and dozens of different possibilities out there. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to reach everybody or vice versa. People didn't reach out to me. And
But I thought we did a nice cross section of different things. I know, like on, for example, on radio shows and podcasts, I was able to promote At the Races because you provide a great service, Steve, for all the horse players. And so you have a listing in the book too, and well deserved.
I appreciate it, and I saw where Scotty was all excited because Equine Edge was discussed, and you know that portion of it. And you know, over the last several months, on a regular basis, as you were reworking the original version, I kept asking you, you know, what are you discovering that surprised you about changes and so forth in the game, and in you know what in the course of human events, 15 years is not really that long, but in our game, it actually is a you know an eternity, really, because PPs have changed, access to replays completely changed. You know, obviously the proliferation of computer assisted wagering, and you know, not just the computer groups assisted wagering, but well, things like Equine Edge and you know, Form to Win, you know, things that have got I hate calling them artificial intelligence, but you know, algorithms and you know, highly developed approaches, you know, through computer programming. You know, there's been countless changes. I mean, the advent of you know, of interactive PPs and you know, the way Formulator works. I mean, the 15 years since you wrote the book, 15 plus, it's actually amazing when you think about it, the you know, the changes you must have encountered.
Oh, no question about it, Steve. And, you know, I would compare it in some ways. You know, you can correct me if you think I'm going down the wrong path, but, you know, when here I live in Vegas, and people bet on all kinds of things, and in my particular interest, I have a keen interest in sports betting, whether it's football, whether it's baseball, whether it's basketball, whether it's hockey. And a term you keep hearing over the years is the increase in the use of what they call analytics, which is kind of an umbrella term for, I believe, statistical studies and programs and algorithms like you just talked about. And I would kind of compare a lot of the things that you just mentioned that I was able to put into the book, kind of horse racing's analytics, and the fact that there are numbers crunchers, there are things that are available to really try to focus in laser sharp on, you know, trying to pick winners and live contenders and stuff like that. So in a lot of ways, we kind of parallel the changes that have been done in sports handicapping. There's just more and more data out there. And I just hope people don't feel like they're getting information overload. But, you know, when you're betting your hard-earned money, there's no question that the more information you have, and even listening to opinions of other people, whether you agree or disagree with them, leads to more, hopefully, intelligent decision-making when you actually make your bets.
Speaking of which, as I discussed earlier this morning, it was just kind of, you know, kind of meandering through the opening. It's not, I don't know, what I do isn't exactly an opening monologue. It's just, you know, my just, you know, talking aimlessly. The ticket structure conversation, not so much structure, Rich, as budget. A couple of thoughts from you when it comes to big multis. Let's kind of focus pick four, pick five, and even pick six. And of course, pick six structure and budget has changed because the denomination has dropped. There's, I think we're down to $1 $2 pick six, right, at Del Mar. The dollar is become, you know, the go-to increment, pretty on a pretty widespread basis. How has your budget on the big multis changed? Because I also think, speaking of wholesale changes to the landscape, I'm also going to say that social media and turf and Twitter in particular has either popularized or made players consider spending more looking for scores. And I say that because, you know, you see, you know, you're seeing a lot of high four-digit and five-digit scores, And invariably, more often than not, the budget utilized is more than what the recreational sort of, you know, fledgling to intermediate player is going to spend. And I would make the dividing line about, I would say over 250 to 400. I'm seeing a lot of those tickets, and I mean, I rarely venture above about a buck and a half. And I'm curious what your treatise is on this, and if your budget and approach has changed.
Well, one of the things that I write about in the book is the fact that, you know, everybody has a budget, you know, except for maybe Jim McInville. Yeah. His betting bankroll is a lot larger than all of ours put together. But, you know, a lot of how you attack the game depends on how much money you have to spend. And, you know, the first thing I write about in the book and tell people is, you know, you should always separate your gambling money from your everyday, you know, paying your rent and your food and keeping the lights on and stuff like that. You don't want to mess with your household account. You should always keep a separate account for gambling. And then, you know, once you have a budget or amount of money, that kind of dictates what you can really do, Steve, because if a person, say, puts, $1,000, $2,000 into a gambling account, it's kind of hard to bet, you know, $400 tickets because, you know, it, obviously you can go through that in a heartbeat, you know, chasing after some of these big wagers. So you have to have flexibility. You have to be able to determine, you know, what is realistic for you. I know personally myself, Steve, you know, even though I can afford to make, larger size tickets, believe it or not, I actually have when I bet pick fives, I don't bet pick sixes a whole lot, but I do bet pick fives and pick fours. I try to keep my ticket around $50, believe it or not. And it can be done, and, it can be effective because, you know, if you're betting a 50 cent minimum, you can actually cover a lot of the bases. And, you know, a key for me with a smaller, cap compared to some other people is I need to find at least like one single, because then that gives me a chance to really investigate the other four races in a little more depth to try to find a price or two, because to make money on those wagers, the most simple premise is you try to beat favorites. And you don't even need $40 horses. If you have a even money horse and you can beat them with a $7 horse, believe it or not, that actually is very helpful to, you know, building value in the end run of the ticket. So, you know, as far as how large a ticket size, a lot depends on the individual, the budget. And, you know, one thing that I kind of get concerned about, especially when I'm dealing with my first time starters and newcomers in betting on horse race for dummy second edition is, you know, one of the drawbacks to a bet like the pick six, we'll just pick on that for this example, is, you know, tickets like that, they're great to win if you can win one. But, in premise, I have a negative view in the fact that, those kind of bets take the money out of the hands of many and put it into the hands of very few. So, you know, in a theoretical sense, I'm not a huge fan of it in the sense that, you know, it kind of drains money, out of the churn, out of the parimutuel system, but puts it in the hands of a few people who are lucky enough to go six for six. So, you know, if you're McInvale, you can go after it. But if you're a small bettor, you probably pick fives, pick fours, pick threes, or you're better off.
And that, you know, that's a very reasonable alternative, and utilizing that leverage, that dollar amount against higher percentage success rate type wagers makes good. And that's a nice piece of advice, Rich.
Yeah, and also, you know, we didn't even touch on takeout, but which is a whole other subject. But it's the same as the hold on sports bets that the bookmakers, you know, profit on. You know, you got to be cognizant of the takeout. If you're betting into a pool that has a 25% or 30% takeout, well, in the long run, that's just going to eat you alive. So you got to be careful.
Rich, we got about a minute and change. Some quick look ahead. How's the first few weekends of Santa Anita treated you? What are your thoughts?
It's been kind of up and down because we've had a lot of head scratching results, but some people have been able to solve the puzzle a little better than I have. But you know, at some point the meet will kind of settle in and the horses will have had a race or two over the track and that kind of thing. And one thing that I've been really happy with is the field sizes, which is hopefully something that can be continued deeper into the meet. It's early, so the inventory is pretty fresh, but I'd love to see that carry through, Steve, his field size.
No, no doubt. And, and frankly, a week ago Sunday, right? The second weekend when the weather, the first salvo in the rough weather patch started, that actually, losing a day like that doesn't hurt. If anything, it just reshuffles the deck and fills out, a couple of cards down the road, a week later or so forth. So, no, I agree. I've been playing each weekend so far, and I'm enjoying it. And, of course, Rich's analysis available at racedaylasvegas.com. And, Rich, good to connect. You got anything on the pro sports front? You got an NFL opinion going into the weekend?
Yeah, I've been doing pretty well with my sports betting, which is, knock on wood, good. I tell you what, if I was going to pick one game to tell people I'm already invested in, is I bet on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers +2.5 against Dallas. I'm going with Brady. He's got a 7-0 record against Dallas for some reason. Of course, a lot of that was when he was with the Patriots, but I really think that Tampa's live at home, so I'm going +2.5.
Excellent. All right. You're from your mouth to God's ears. Rich Eng, everybody. Rich Eng, number four, pro pick, and the new betting on horse racing for dummies. Rich, talk to you next week. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks. Best of luck, Steve, and all the listeners.
Rich Eng, everybody, along with Alan Foreman, Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Folk, is brought to you by Hill and Dale. Jack Wolf joining us from Australia, which was fun, and Jay Pribman on the occasion of his distinction of a special eclipse award for career excellence. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9 here on Sirius XM. Talk to you weekend preview, brought to you by Twin Spires. Talk to you tomorrow.
The races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research.